listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for February 15. I'm Kaylin Bolster from Drake University. Here's our first story. Young artists bring Valentine's Day cheer to seniors at Fox Run, written by Tim Johnson. Children in Family Incorporated's Family Support Program have been working to brighten Valentine's Day weekend for residents at Fox Run Assisted Living. During the past month, children aged 5 and younger from all over Pottawatomie County have made plenty of Valentine's Day cards for Fox Run seniors, according to Lauren Rollins, Family Engagement Coordinator for Family Incorporated. Since Family Incorporated is doing home visits virtually due to the pandemic, staff just dropped off supplies families could use to make the cards. It's a great way for our families to give back, she said. It's also a fun project for the children and a way for them to work on their fine motor skills, Rollins said. The instigator of the project was Jean Bachner, an elder care advisor for assisted living locators and former employee of Family. She shared the idea with Rollins, who took it from there. The kids in the community wanted to give out some love after not being able to visit people for a while, said Bachner, who helps families find assisted living options for their loved ones. Fox Run residents have had some lonely times during the COVID-19 pandemic, but they are currently allowed to have visitors by appointment, said McKenna Murphy, senior living counsel at Fox Run. Still, she was sure the facility's 65 residents would appreciate the special greeting from the children. I think they're really going to like that, she said. On Friday, Rollins delivered the cards to the senior living facility's cafeteria, where Murphy had gathered a small group of residents. Staff members handed out masks covered with hearts donated by Sherry Blakeman, Director of Environmental Services. As expected, the cards were well received by the residents. It's nice, said Julia McGrew. These are nice cards, said Betty Bettler. These are so cute. Carl Knudsen said the cards were a nice surprise. The cards varied in design and decorations. Some young artists had colored in a heart-shaped outline. Others had written Happy Valentine's Day and decorated the card with heart stickers. Some cards had hearts on them that contained stripes, wavy lines, and or polka dots, and some were hearts cut out of red construction paper with accordion-like arms and legs. One made by six-month-old Franklin featured two red footprints. The card said, "From the bottom of my heart to the tips of my toes, I love you." Family staff member Rachel Zeller's daughters in middle and high school had made numerous cards by fastening two wooden hearts together and gluing on letters from a Scrabble game to spell words like caring, loving, etc. A staff member pointed out the Valentine's to a couple approaching the dining room. "Here's my Valentine," said John Klug, putting his arm around his wife, Shirley. That concludes our first heartwarming story to start off Monday. The second story is called Forecast. Snow and cold continues with possible reprieve at end of week, written by Mike Brownlee. Groundhog Day came out in 1993 and starred Billy Murray as a man who repeated the same day over and over. "It's cold and snowy" is a weather condition experienced in the Midwest over and over yearly. And we don't even have the option of finding true love to get us out of it. After days and nights of snow paired with temperatures below zero, today brings more of the same, a high around negative 2 degrees and a 30% chance of snow during the day, according to the National Weather Service in Valley, Nebraska. The Weather Service said a winter weather advisory remains in the metro area into this Sunday evening, with snow amounts 1 to 3 inches possible over that time, adding to the mounds of snow already on the ground. A wind chill advisory is in effect and will last into this evening, with values from negative 20 to negative 30 possible at times. The nighttime low is negative 16. Monday and Tuesday brings highs of negative 3 and 0, respectively, before things start to warm up a little. Warm being a relative construct in this instant, but hey, after these low temps, the high of 30 on Friday is going to feel downright balmy. Here's a look at the upcoming forecast. Today, a 30% chance of snow before noon, mostly cloudy and cold, with a high near negative 2, wind chill values as low as negative 27, north wind 10 to 13 miles per hour with gusts as high as 18 miles per hour. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low around negative 16, wind chill values as low as negative 31, north wind 7 to 10 miles per hour. Washington's birthday, mostly sunny and cold with a high near negative 3, north northeast wind 5 to 8 miles per hour. Monday night, partly cloudy with a low around negative 21, Tuesday, mostly sunny and cold with a high near zero. Tuesday night, mostly cloudy with a low around negative 6. Wednesday, partly sunny with a high near 11. Wednesday night, partly cloudy with a low around negative 3. Thursday, mostly sunny with a high near 17. Thursday night, partly cloudy with a low around 6, and Friday, mostly sunny with a high near 30. So that's a look at your local weather. Continuing on with the local news, Trump acquitted Senate votes 57-43 on impeachment trial. Grassley-Ernst vote to acquit. This was written by Lisa Mascaro, Eric Tucker, and Mary Claire Jelonek. Washington. The Senate on Saturday acquitted Donald Trump of inciting the horrific attack on the U.S. Capitol, concluding a historic impeachment trial that exposed the fragility of America's democratic traditions and left a divided nation to come to terms with the violence sparked by his defeated presidency. Barely a month since the deadly January 6th riot that stunned the world, the Senate convened for a rare weekend session to deliver its verdict, voting while armed National Guard troops continued to stand their posts outside the iconic building. The quick trial, the nation's first of a former president, showed how perilously close the invaders had come to destroying the nation's deep tradition of a peaceful transfer of presidential power after Trump had refused to concede the election. Rallying outside the White House, he unleashed a mob of supporters to fight like hell for him at the Capitol, just as Congress was certifying Democrat Joe Biden's victory. As hundreds stormed the building, some in tactical gear engaging in bloody combat with police, lawmakers fled for their lives. 5 people died. The verdict on a vote of 57-43 is all but certain to influence not only the former president's political future, but that of the senators sworn to deliver impartial justice as jurors. 7 Republicans joined all Democrats to convict, but it was far from the 2/3 threshold required. The outcome after the uprising leaves unresolved the nation's wrenching divisions over Trump's brand of politics that led to the most violent domestic attack on one of America's 3 branches of government. Senators, we are in a dialogue with history, a conversation with our past, with a hope for our future, said Republican Madeline Dean, one of the House prosecutors in closing arguments. What we do here, what is being asked of each of us in this moment will be remembered. Trump, unrepentant, welcomed his second impeachment acquittal and said his movement has only just begun. He slammed the trial as yet another phase of the greatest witch hunt in the history of our country. Though he was acquitted, it was easily the largest number of senators to ever vote to find a president of their own party guilty of an impeachment charge. Voting to find Trump guilty were GOP senators Richard Burr of North Carolina, Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Mitt Romney of Utah, Ben Saw of Nebraska, and Patrick Toomey of Pennsylvania. Iowa Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, both Republicans, voted to acquit Trump. In his statement for the Senate record, Grassley reiterated that the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol was an assault to democracy itself, and that Trump had displayed poor leadership. Grassley, however, said the impeachment managers for the House of Representatives failed to prove their case. We do not have the authority to try a private citizen like former President Trump, Grassley said in the statement for the Senate record. Even if we did, he should have been accorded the protections of due process of law in his trial. And even if we assume he has been, the House managers still did not prove that he committed incitement to insurrection, the specific crime of which he stands accused. This does not excuse President Trump's conduct in around January 6th of this year. Sasse said in a statement that he viewed his vote as a public declaration of what a president's oath of office means and what behavior that oath demands of future presidents. But here's the sad reality, Sasse said. If we were talking about a Democratic president, most Republicans and most Democrats would simply swap sides. Tribalism is a hell of a drug, but our oath to the Constitution means we're constrained to the facts. Sasse said Trump lied by saying he won the 2020 presidential election by a landslide. He said Trump lied about widespread voter fraud, despite losing 60 straight court challenges, including in front of judges that Trump appointed. Sasse said Trump tried to urge Georgia election officials to find votes and overturn the state's election results. He also said Trump falsely insisted former Vice President Mike Pence to disregard his oath and declare a different winner. The president repeated these lies when summoning his crowd, parts of which were widely known to be violent, to Capitol Hill to intimidate Vice President Pence and Congress into not fulfilling our constitutional duties, Sasse said. Those lies had consequences, endangering the life of the Vice President and bringing us dangerously close to a bloody constitutional crisis. In his statement, Sasse reiterated his stance that the legislative branch, Congress, needed to stand up and defend its prerogatives in more than just the extreme cases that led to Trump's impeachment. A weak and timid Congress will increasingly submit to an emboldened and empowered presidency, he said. This institution needs to respect itself enough to tell the executive that some lines cannot be crossed. Even after voting to acquit, the Republican leader, Mitch McConnell, condemned the former president as practically and morally responsible for the insurrection. Trump could not be convicted because he was out of office, McConnell contended. The trial had been momentarily thrown into confusion when senators suddenly wanted to consider potential witnesses, an hours-long standoff Saturday that called the momentum toward a vote. Prolonged proceedings would be potentially risky, particularly for Biden's new presidency and his emerging legislative agenda. Coming amid the searing COVID-19 crisis, the Biden White House is trying to rush pandemic relief through Congress. Biden has hardly weighed in on the proceedings and was spending the weekend with family at the presidential retreat in Camp David, Maryland. The nearly week-long trial has delivered a grim and graphic narrative of the riot and its consequences in ways that senators, most of whom fled for their own safety that day, acknowledge they are still coming to grips with. House prosecutors have argued that Trump was the incitor-in-chief, stoking a months-long campaign, an orchestrated pattern of violent rhetoric and false claims they called the Big Lie that unleashed the mob. Five people died, including a rioter who was shot and a police officer. Trump's lawyers countered that Trump's words were not intended to incite the violence and that impeachment is nothing but a witch hunt designed to prevent him from serving in office again. The senators announcing their votes from their desks were not only jurors but also witnesses. Only by watching the graphic videos, rioters calling out menacingly for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Vice President Mike Pence, who was presiding over the January certification tally, did senators say they began to understand just how perilously close the country came to chaos. Many senators kept their votes closely held until the final moments on Saturday, particularly the Republicans representing states where the former president remains popular. Most of them ultimately voted to acquit, doubting whether Trump was fully responsible or if impeachment is the appropriate response. Just look at what Republicans have been forced to defend, said Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. Look at what Republicans have chosen to forgive. In closing arguments, lead prosecutor Michael Van Der Veen fell back on the procedural argument that Republican senators have embraced in their own reasoning of the case, what he said is a phony impeachment show trial. Mr. Trump is innocent of the charges against him, said Michael Van Der Veen. The act of incitement never happened. The House impeached Trump on the sole charge of incitement of insurrection 1 week after the riot, the most bipartisan vote of a presidential impeachment. The delay Saturday came as senators wanted to hear evidence about Trump's actions during the riot. Fresh stories overnight focus on Republican Chaim Herrera Butler of Washington State, who said in a statement late Friday that Trump rebuffed a plea from House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy to call off the rioters. 55 senators voted for to consider witnesses, including Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Ben Sasse of Nebraska, and Mitt Romney of Utah. Once they did, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina changed his vote to join them on the 55-45 vote. But facing a prolonged trial with defense poised to call many more witnesses, the situation was resolved when Herrera Butler's statement on the call was read aloud into the record for senators to consider as evidence. As part of the deal, Democrats dropped their planned deposition and Republicans abandoned their threat to call their own witnesses. Impeachment trials are rare. Senators meeting as the court of impeachment over a president only 4 times in the nation's history, for Andrew Johnson, Bill Clinton, and now twice for Trump, the only one to be twice impeached. Unlike last year's impeachment trial of Trump in the Ukraine affair, a complicated charge of corruption and obstruction over his attempts to have the foreign ally dig up dirt on then-campaign rival Biden. This one brought an emotional punch displayed in graphic videos of the siege that laid bare the unexpected vulnerability of a democratic system. At the same time, this year's trial carried similar warnings from the prosecutors pleading with senators that Trump must be held accountable because he has shown repeatedly he has no bounds. Left unchecked, he will further test the norms of civic behavior, even now that he is out of office, still commanding loyal supporters. This trial is the final analysis. In the final analysis, is not about Donald Trump, said lead prosecutor Republican James Raskin. The trial is about who we are. Omaha World Herald reporter Aaron Sandiford contributed to this report as well. So that concludes this story. For our next story, it's titled Dance to the Beat 2021 is a virtual event, but support it provides is real, by Jenny Edmondson Foundation. A lot of factors came together on a cold evening in January 2019 that some might call coincidence, but Dr. Ronald Bendorf believes they were blessings that saved his life, and that the greatest is the expert care he received from the Methodist Jenny Edmondson cardiac team. "I'm convinced I would not be here today if the ambulance had taken me anywhere else," said Bendorf, 83, a retired Council Bluffs psychiatrist. "The quality of care I received from the cardiac program is unparalleled." Bendorf wants the people of Western Iowa to realize how fortunate they are to have a nationally accredited cardiac program in Council Bluffs. He hopes his fellow Iowans will support the center in the annual Dance to the Beat fundraiser to benefit uninsured and underinsured cardiovascular patients at Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital. Due to COVID-19, this year's Dance to the Beat on February 25 will be a virtual event accessible online. The need for expert cardiac care and for financial support to supplement that care didn't stop because of the pandemic, said Tara Slevin, Vice President and Chief Philanthropy Officer at Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital. "Though we can't gather together as we have in the past, we still rely upon our friends, continued generosity, and support of events, including Dance to the Beat. Dance to the Beat has a twofold purpose. One goal is to raise funds to help cardiovascular patients over some of the uninsured costs of their care, such as transportation and medications," Slevin said. "The second is to raise awareness of the importance of exercise, nutrition, and other factors that improve cardiac health. Without the support of our sponsors, donors, and communities, we couldn't accomplish either goal." This is the fifth year for the fundraiser and the first for a virtual format. It will feature a silent auction, a message from Methodist Jenny Edmondson cardiologist, and patient stories. One of these stories will be Bendorf's. It began in 2007 when he underwent a four-vessel cardiac bypass surgery. The operation was successful, but over time he began to experience further blockage issues. A physician he visited in Omaha recommended that Bendorf travel out of the area to have stents placed in four of his heart vessels. Bendorf and his wife, Judy, traveled to another state and he underwent the surgery in January 2019. The cardiac surgeons, however, had difficulty placing the stents, and because of the extensive time Bendorf was under anesthesia, were only able to place three of the four stents, said Bendorf's son, Dr. Eric Bendorf, a general surgeon at Methodist Jenny Edmondson Hospital. After about a week, the Bendorfs returned to their rural home along Highway 92, midway between Council Bluffs and Trenor. Bendorf's son-in-law, Matt, offered to come and clear Bendorf's driveway of snow. Bendorf's daughter, Emily, said she would come along with the couple's children and they would all have dinner together. Bendorf believes that was the first blessing. "After dinner, I started to have a pain in my chest," he recalled. "It wasn't good. I started to get up from my chair and slump back over." Emily immediately called 911. Lewis Township Fire and Rescue responded, and a paramedic who was nearby drove directly to Bendorf's home. "I really think if Emily hadn't been there, what was happening might have gone unnoticed," Bendorf said. "Judy was busy in the kitchen, and I was in another room. After being placed in the ambulance, Judy telephoned their son, Eric, that they say was blessing number two. It just so happened to be the night of the annual medical staff meeting and dinner at Jenny Ed," said Eric. "I was sitting in the cafeteria, and nearby were Dr. Joseph T. Iob and Dr. Robert W. Armbruster, two of Jenny's cardiologists. I told them my dad was on his way in." The three doctors met the ambulance at the emergency room and within minutes had taken Ronald to the cardiac center's cardiac catheterization lab. Iob and Armbruster worked together to open one of the stents that had collapsed and also placed a stent in the fourth vessel, which had not been opened in the earlier operation of out of state. Eric said his father has since had a pacemaker implanted and continues under the care of Dr. Iob. "He's doing very well," he said. Eric said he was unaware of the extensive cardiac capabilities in place at Methodist Jenny Edmondson until after his father traveled out of state for his operation and required emergency care that January evening. "The camaraderie and collaboration between the cardiologists is amazing," he said. "In my 23 years, I've always felt the administration strives to be partners with the physicians, and that sort of culture is conducive to good patient care all around. The Methodist Jenny Edmondson Cardiac Program include the catheterization lab, a heart failure program, a congestive heart disease intervention program, cardiac rehabilitation services, and inpatient care. The hospital's chest pain center offers 24/7 comprehensive, time-critical care to patients with acute coronary symptoms. The care team is part of an advanced cardiology services network that stretches throughout Western Iowa to deliver timely, individualized procedures, treatments, and therapies, along with education aimed at preventing heart disease. In addition to IUBUB and Armbruster, the teams includes cardiologist Dr. Thomas Brandt, physician's assistant Alexa Gerza, and nurse practitioners Angela Claiborne and Rachel Kronowski. Dr. Brandt and his wife Becky are driving force behind creating Dance to the Beat and are supported by a long list of generous sponsors. Along with the cardiac care nurses and other medical professionals, the cardiologists actively partner with caregivers at other hospitals throughout the region, as well as with emergency medical services, first responders who answer the 911 calls for help every day. The cardiac care team works directly with the American Heart Association and its mission, Lifeline, national initiative to reduce mortality and morbidity for cardiac patients while improving overall patient outcomes. In addition, the cardiac center delivers immediate and continuing treatment, follow-up therapy, and community education aimed at preventing cardiac problems. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor or for more information about Dance to the Beat or the Jenny Edmondson Foundation, visit jfoundation.org or call the foundation at 712-396-6040. And that concludes the end of this story. Furthermore, another story on today's news is transgender bathroom bill unlikely to advance, key Iowa lawmaker says. This is written by Aaron Murphy and Le Des Moines Bureau. Legislative proposals to bar transgender Iowa students from using bathrooms designated for the gender with which they identify appears unlikely to advance in the Iowa House. Republicans in the Iowa Senate recently advanced such a bill. Senate file 224 through its first step in the legislative process, but Republican Dustin Height, chairman of the Iowa House Education Committee, said Friday that he has no plans to give the bill or ones like it a hearing in the House. Height made the comments during taping of this weekend's episode of Iowa Press on Iowa PBS. The reason I haven't assigned them a subcommittee is not because I don't understand the issues of the proponents of those bills, but I also understand the issues on the other sides of those bills, Height said. And I think when we talk about topics like this, we have to be extremely careful that what we are doing does not come across as hateful. And that is what I'm always concerned about in these particular issues. When asked if the proposal would receive a hearing in the education committee, he leads, I all but eliminated any possibility. Those bills have not been assigned a subcommittee in my committee. I don't necessarily believe that that's probably going to happen anytime soon, if ever, this session, he said. For years, some conservatives have pushed for laws that would bar transgender men and women from using men's restrooms and transgender women and girls from using women's restrooms. They typically argue safety. Iowa Safe Schools, a nonprofit LGBTQ advocacy organization, said there have been no reported instances of inappropriate behavior by transgender Iowans in public restrooms since 2007, when Iowa's Civil Rights Act was expanded to include sexual orientation and gender identity. We applaud Representative Height for taking a stand for a safe and inclusive Iowa for everyone. Iowa Safe Schools Interim Executive Director Becky Ritland said in a statement, "The rights of LGBTQ Iowans are not a partisan issue, and we look forward to continuing our work across the aisle to ensure that every elected official fully embodies what it means to be Iowanice." During an education-themed Iowa press show, Height and fellow guest Representative Ras Smith, the top Democrat of the House Education Committee, discussed the myriad pieces of public education legislation that have been moving through the Iowa legislature during its opening month. On another controversial education bill, Height did not say whether he will hold a committee hearing on a proposal to ban K-12 schools from using curriculum based off the 1619 Project, a project by the New York Times that examines the impact of slavery on American history. Some historians have claimed the project has historical inaccuracies and question some of the theories presented, and some conservatives take issues with the project's framing of the role slavery played in the founding of the U.S. Those who have defended the 1619 Project says it educates young Americans about the history of slavery in a way that textbooks traditionally have not, and they oppose the bill as a legislative overreach into schools' affairs. Several prominent, including left-leaning historians, have come out and said this is just bad history, and to use it as a history curriculum, I think that is the concern we're hearing, Height said. Now to Representative Smith's point, there is also concern about us dictating what schools should and should not teach, maybe starts to get out of line. And that concludes our local news. You're listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for February 15 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Kaylin Balser from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Now for the opinion section of the news. Murphy column, high demand for COVID-19 vaccine is great news. Now about that supply. Written by Aaron Murphy in the Lee Des Moines Bureau. Supply and demand is an economic principle that is as basic as they come, and it's what we're all dealing with during the roll of the COVID-19 vaccines. There's a lot of demand for limited supply. Isn't it wonderful? Not the part about people who want the vaccine being unable to get it or being forced to wait. That, of course, is not good, especially if that group includes any Iowans who are among those most vulnerable to the virus's dangerous and deadly effects. But the fact that so many people want to get the vaccine is encouraging news for those of us who want to be rid of COVID-19, or at least relegate it to the sideline, where it will be a minor annoyance, not a colossal and deadly hassle. Public health and infectious disease experts say widespread administration of the COVID-19 vaccine is crucial to helping us all move closer to that long-sought return to normal, or at least as close to normalcy as we'll ever see again. With so many Iowans showing a clear desire to get the vaccine, we can feel heartened we are moving down the right path. Now it's up to our government leaders and bodies to meet this challenging moment. That demand is so high that government bodies cannot keep us in. In some ways, a good problem to have. Obviously, it would be better to have no problem at all, but we could all be sitting here with millions of doses of vaccine and nobody willing to take them. That would be worse. With demand outweighing supply, the pressure is on the federal, state, and local governments to streamline the process and get shots into Iowans' arms as quickly and as safely as possible. To be sure, that's very much a simple statement about a remarkably complex project. Nevertheless, it is the monumental but critical challenge that faces all of our government bodies. The partnerships between all levels of government and between governmental bodies and private institutions must continue to improve in order to keep in motion a rapid and steady assembly line. That's why Iowans continue to seek the vaccine and why they have so many questions about the process. And it's why reporters continue to ask government leaders about the rollout. Lives literally depend on it. Public education is in the spotlight. Iowa's K-12 public schools often get a decent amount of attention early in each year's session of the legislature because typically state lawmakers try to set school funding for the next budget year early each session. But public education in general, this session has taken up a lot of oxygen in the Iowa legislature. Setting aside whether that's a good or a bad thing, quick synopsis. Most public school advocates think it's mostly a bad thing because of the specific proposals on the table. It is still fairly remarkable how much legislation is moving early this session that impacts public education. In addition to the typical funding bill and debate, lawmakers have already passed a pandemic-related measure that requires school districts to offer to all students the option of 100% in-person learning. Currently being considered is a sweeping bill by Governor Kim Reynolds that devotes taxpayer funding for private school tuition, expands the state's charter school program, and eliminates diversity plans that preclude students from transferring out of a school. More recently, advancing was a bill that would ban K-12 and college curriculum using a New York Times project on the history of slavery in the U.S., and the legislation has reached the state's three public universities, one bill that banned tenure, and another would have the colleges pull the political affiliation of their staff. That's a heavy focus on education in the early going. It could be a monumental year for new education policy in the state. And now we're going to listen to some obituaries. Charles M. Zink, December 14, 1948, February 8, 2021. Charles was a contract manager for Johnson Hardware Company, retiring in 2014 after 38 years of service, preceded in death by parents Charles and Helen Zink, survived by wife Mary Zink, siblings Mary Ann Zink, Stephen Zink, Kathleen Hallelujah, Thomas Zink, Karen Lena Felter, Carla Finnegan, Joe Zink, and Matt Schlossler, nieces, nephews, other loving family and friends. Memorial service Tuesday at 11 a.m., with visitation starting at 10 a.m. at the St. John Lutheran Church, Interment in Memorial Park Cemetery. To plant trees in memory, please visit our sympathy store. And then next, in memory of Dick Spencer, he passed away on February 13, 2021. Dick Spencer from February 13, 1941 to August 9, 2020. Today would have been your 80th birthday. Our minds still talk to you. Our hearts still look for you. Our souls know you are at peace, thinking of you, missing you, loving you always. Troy, Katie, Mindy, Melissa, and Carly, to plant trees in memory, please visit our sympathy store. Hiltrude Trudy A. Nixon passed away Thursday, February 11, 2021 at home. She was 79 years old. She was born in Germany. She moved to the United States in 1960. She lived in Council Bluffs, Iowa, where she worked at Charles Snyder's making furniture. She moved to Box Elder, South Dakota in 2012. She was preceded in death by her husband, James D. Nixon, her parents and brother and sister in Germany. She survived by her son, Scott D. Nixon, two grandchildren, Stephen D. Nixon and Jessica L. Nixon, three great-grandchildren, brother Kurt Groff, many nieces and nephews in Germany. There will be a private family-only memorial. Please make any memorial donations to the Humane Society of the Black Hills, Burns Wilson Funeral Home. Margaret McCownan. Corinne McCownan, Margaret Corrine McCowan, age 93, of Bass Hoar, Kansas, passed away peacefully in her sleep on Saturday, February 6, 2021. Visitation will be 1 to 2 p.m., funeral service 2 p.m., both Friday, February 19, 2021, at the Auburn Presbyterian Church. Due to COVID-19 restrictions, face masks and social distancing are required, with burial following in the Auburn Cemetery in Auburn, Kansas. Memorial contributions can be made to the Auburn Presbyterian Church in care of the Alden Harrington Funeral Home. And now for some sports. Mitch Albom, Matthew Stafford's last Detroit Lions interview, how hard it was for him to say goodbye, written by Mitch Albom. Matthew Stafford goes all out. If he plays football, he plays to the dying breath. If he's with his kids, he's totally with his kids. If he vacations, he truly vacations. And if he talks, really talks, he'll talk about everything. We had one of those talks last Monday when his four daughters were put to bed and his house was quiet, and he could focus on the whirlwind path his life had taken since word got out that he and the Detroit Lions had agreed on a departure. Since then, he'd gone from a certain Lion to a maybe Colt, maybe 49er, maybe Washingtonian, and a definite LA Ram. But last week, he'd already taken an exploratory trip with his wife, Kelly, to find a new home out west. And together, they decided to make a parting gesture to Detroit, a $1 million donation to build a new education center in one of the city's most challenged neighborhoods as part of Say, Detroit's Say Play Center at Lake Park. He was happy, he was sad, he was nostalgic, he was optimistic. What follows is excerpts of a long, winding conversation in which Stafford, 33, looked both forwards and backwards after 12 years in the NFL, all of them with a team he says he will always be a part of. The backdrop. When you first got here, even though Detroit wasn't a successful NFL town, did you want to play your whole career? Yeah, I never thought I would ever finish my career anywhere else. That was one of the things that made it difficult to go the route that we went. I mean, I saw myself having a retirement press conference with Martha Ford and Shayla Ford and a bunch of ex-teammates and local people I know. To me, for the longest time, the true sign of a guy who had success in my position was somebody that stayed in the same place. Now it changed a little bit with Brett Favre going to a couple different places late. And I know Joe Montana did that as well. But for the most part, that was to me a baseline for success. Being able to stay in the same place. And could I have done that? Yeah, probably. But you know, I wanted to shoot my shot. As much as I'm moving to a place that's got some pieces that are ready to go, I'm also betting on myself, betting that I'm the person that can take them there. So this is a big challenge for me. But I'm going to miss the hell out of this place. Were you encouraged by what happened in the Super Bowl, where a new veteran quarterback took a previously mediocre team to a championship? Absolutely. I mean, Tom Brady's an incredible player, and what he's able to do is second to none. But it did give me a little boost, and also knowing that the guys that really affected that Super Bowl weren't even on the roster last year. So you can add a couple guys here and there, it can make a big difference. And it was also cool to see that the home team can make it to the Super Bowl. Next year's Super Bowl is in LA. Did your aging career years convince you this was the time to take that chance? Yeah, you know, I've always wanted to play in those big games. I always feel like I will excel in those situations. And sometimes it's not the perfect storybook ending in the same place. But I can also leave here knowing that I gave this place every damn thing I had. At the same time, obviously, I'm going to miss the people, man, people who were such a big part of my life. The decision. I guess an obvious question then would be, since you love it here so much, why did you initiate the move to leave? The biggest thing for me was just seeing where we were as a team and how long I thought I was going to take for us to be where we needed to be to compete for a championship, truly compete for a championship, not make the playoffs or any of that. And you know, I just felt like we were a ways away. To be honest, Kelly and I probably started talking about it before last season. It was one of those things where, you know, we were hoping that, golly, let's go. I hope this thing takes off and we play great and I'm here for the next 10 years and we win 2 Super Bowls. But if it doesn't, you just knew what was going to happen. They were going to tear it down and rebuild. And anytime you switch GMs and head coach, they're going to want to bring their own people in. And that's going to take time. And I frankly didn't feel like I was the appropriate person to oversee that time. Were you worried about being stuck in the middle where the team is neither really good or really bad and you can't draft your way out of it? In my mind, I feel like I was going to be able to help us go win 6, 7, 8 games because I wasn't going to let us lose more than that, you know? But I probably wasn't good enough by myself to help us win more than that. And maybe we don't ever get those top picks that we needed. What was the meeting like where you told the Lions you felt this way? As I was going in, I actually texted Kelly and was like, well, here I go. You were by yourself. Yeah. You just walked in with you and Rod Wood. Me and Rod and Sheila was on the speakerphone. She was taking care of her grandkids. And I kind of said how I felt. I wasn't really expecting anything. I just needed to say what I needed to say. And there was so much respect coming from me towards the organization. And then I said where my vision for this team was 5 years from now and who that involved and who it didn't involve. It was tough for me to say because, I mean, I had so much pride putting on the Lions uniform every Sunday and going out there being something the city could be proud of and the Fords could be proud of. So Rod was in the room with you? Yeah. But were you wearing a mask? Yes. So it's kind of hard to see how somebody is reacting when they're wearing a mask and you can't see Sheila because she's on a box, right? Which was tough, you know, because I'm just kind of staring at this phone. I'll never forget it, but she was incredible, and Rod was great. There's a lot of respect there from both parties, and I think that's, you know, what made this one of the rare instances where it was amicable. I can't give them enough credit the way they've handled it, and I hope they feel the same way about me. Was there ever an awkward moment where you finished starting your position and there was silence on the phone for a second, like you weren't sure how they were going to take it? For sure it was. I can't speak for Sheila and Ron, but I can't imagine that they were 100% surprised. I think at some point it had to probably cross their minds, just knowing where we were as a team and where I was as a player. I shared my disappointments and not being able to bring them what I ultimately wanted, a championship. It was a tough conversation, probably the hardest one I've ever had, but one that I walked out of, frankly blown away, with their support and their understanding. The aftermath. Did you call Kelly from the car afterwards? I think I texted Kelly and was like, well, that went as well as it possibly could, and called her on the way home. She knew how hard it was for me. You didn't have any seller's remorse, like, oh wait, what did I just do? No, I didn't. It was not something that was a spur of the moment. You know, I want nothing more than to be able to come back to this place 10 years from now and everybody welcome me with open arms. And that was one of the biggest things that was weighing on me as I went in there. I don't want anybody to ever feel like I'm giving up on this town or this city or this place. I gave it everything I possibly had here, and I just wanted the opportunity to see if I can do it somewhere else. Still, there was no guarantee they were going to argue with you. No, there wasn't. They had every right to go. Well, I'm sorry you feel that way, but you've got 2 years left on your deal, so you're going to be here next year. But the way the team has handled it, I think it's worked out for everybody, and I think it will in the future. I cannot express how much gratitude I feel towards them. Were you surprised at how understanding Lions fans have been? It's been incredible. Kelly and I were at breakfast the other morning after we dropped the girls off at school, and a woman came up and cried, not just for me, but for Kelly too. You know, I don't see hardly any of the Instagram stuff that she puts out there, but I know she's made a big time connection with the mothers here in Detroit. And you know, this woman was just pouring her heart out to us. And today we were at lunch at Jay Alexander's up at the Somerset Collection, and we had 4 people come up to us who were like, thank you for what you did, not only on the field, but in the community. And hey man, we're going to be pulling for you every time the Rams are playing, as long as you're not playing the Lions. It's such a fun thing for Kelly and I. And honestly, with all of our hearts, we can say the feeling is mutual. The destination. Where do you think you will end up once a trade was agreed upon? When it started, I thought all the places that everybody else thought. Indianapolis, San Francisco, although you didn't know what was going to happen with Jimmy. Washington, but we obviously didn't know what was going to happen there. What about LA? It was a long shot. I just didn't know how they would ever be able to pull it off. I'm not a salary cap guru. It kind of got to a point where I'm like, okay, I can't sit there and go crazy. I just tried to let it happen. And LA aggressively jumped into it. Is it accurate that you told the Lions you did not want to go to New England under any circumstance? Well, what's accurate is, and this is the incredible thing by them, I asked to go to a team that was ready to win a championship. And you know, there were a few teams on that list. There were a few teams that were not on that list. And they were respectful of that and understood completely. I had thoughts and reasons for each of them. You were in Cabo San Lucas when the LA trade went down. Yeah, on a little vacation, and just by coincidence, some other NFL guys were there too. And Andrew Whitworth, the Rams' veteran offensive lineman, was there as well as Sean McVay, the Rams' coach. And I saw Whitworth in the hot tub, and he waved at me and said, "Hey, we're making a run at you." And I was like, okay. Until then, you didn't even know that they were in on it? Yeah, I mean, I didn't even think that. I didn't know how it would make sense. And by the end of the day, the deal was done. Yeah. Finally, do you think you would have been a different player or a different person if you hadn't been drafted by Detroit? I think I like to think that I would have gutted it through just as much as anywhere else, but I can tell you for certain that Detroit is a place I was proud to embody on the field. I'm excited to go play in LA. I'm excited to go into this brand new stadium they built, but at the same time, one of the things I loved about Ford Field is that it wasn't all glitz and glam. It was nice, but it wasn't all this other stuff going on. You knew that people were there for one reason, to see the game and to make the other team's life a living hell. To cheer on the Lions, that was awesome. And that concludes our story about the Lions. So if you're a Lions fan out there, I'm sure you're kind of sad to see Matt go. Now, for a local sports story, Wieskamp led number 15 Iowa routes Michigan State 88-55. And this is written by Larry Lang. East Lansing, Luca Garza had his worst game offensively in 2-plus years, and number 15 Iowa still had enough for the rest of its team to rout Michigan State 88-58 on Saturday. The Hawkeyes, 15-6, 9-5 in the Big Ten, had three players score in double figures, and Garza wasn't one of them, showing future opponents that focusing so much on him is not a formula for success. "It just changes everything," Coach Fran McCaffrey acknowledged. Garza's teammates more than made up for the star senior being held to 8 points, well below his 20-point average, and missing 8 of 11 shots from the field. The Spartans swarmed around the 6'11 center when he had the ball in the post, leaving his teammates open on the outside, and they took advantage. Joe Wieskamp scored 21 points, Jack Nunge matched a career high with 18 points, and Connor McCaffrey added 16 points for the Hawkeyes. The trio combined to make 10 of 15 three-pointers, helping the team connect on 13 of 25 shots beyond the arc after the defense collapsed on Garza. "He drew guys and passed it when he needed to, Nudge said. The staggering Spartans, 10-8 and 4-8, are in danger of missing the NCAA tournament for the first time since 1997. Michigan State started the afternoon hoping to earn a quality win against a team it lost by just 6 points to earlier this month. It walked off the court disheartened by the most lopsided loss in Coach Team Izzo's 26-year career in charge of the programs. And if the Hawkeyes didn't show mercy, they might have challenged Indiana's 52-point win in 1975. That stands as the largest margin of defeat at home for the Spartans. "I'm embarrassed," Izzo said softly. Michigan State's Gabe Brown had 15 points, Aaron Henry scored 13 points, and Joshua Langford added 11 points for a team that has to close the season strong to have a shot to play in College Basketball Showcase. "We still believe we can make this run, and we're going to," Brown insisted. Iowa led 46-26 at halftime after making 8 of 13 beyond the arc. The Spartans briefly put up a fight in the second half, pulling within 15 points before the Hawkeyes had their way at both ends of the court to win at the Breesland Center for the first time since 2016. "Today was an ambush," Izzo said. Big picture. Iowa. Teams can throw the kitchen sink at Garza, as Izzo said his team did, and did not beat the Hawkeyes. He scored at least 16 points in every other game this season. Garza had his lowest total since scoring 9 points on November 29, 2019, against San Diego State. He was a sophomore the last time a Big Ten team held him to single digits. Garza, though, celebrated the win without hesitation. "What's really impressive for me was how happy Luca was in the locker room," Coach Fran McCaffrey said. Michigan State, Izzo was in his second season the last time he didn't coach in the NCAA tournament, and the next time might be next month. "We know what our goal is and what we have to do," the Hall of Fame coach said. Pandemic play. Spartans guard Rocket Watts was held out of the second half for health and safety precautions, the school said, after he had 3 points on 1-for-5 shooting over 10 minutes. Rocket was sick, Issa said. Watts was put in isolation at a nearby hotel following COVID-19 protocols. Michigan State had 2 games postponed last month because of an outbreak within its programs. Poll implications. The Hawkeyes should move up in the top 25 after rooting Michigan State on the road and beating number 25 Rutgers by 13 points earlier in the week. They fell out of the top 10 this week for the first time this season after losing to then number 7, Ohio State and Indiana. And that wraps up this story. So if there's any Hawk fans out there, they're definitely having an impressive season so far. And now for an even more local sports news story. All wrestlers punch tickets to state tournament, written by Austin Heinen. Abraham Lincoln, Lewis Central, and Thomas Jefferson wrestled at AL for the Class 3A District 3 Individuals Tournament. Lewis Central will send Tanner Wink at Class 120 as a district champ to state, along with Tabor Dominguez, who finished second in the 126th class. The state tournament will be in Des Moines at Wells Fargo Arena and begin on February 17 and go through February 20. For Wink, it will be his fourth trip to the Wells Fargo Arena and the state wrestling tournament. The seniors hope to end his career at the podium at state, as he fell short in his previous 3 trips. This is where you want to cap off your season at, Wink said, especially if I can medal there too. It's a big statement. My goal is to get past the first day and into the next session so I know I'll place. That's my main goal, to get on that podium. Notably for LC, Brain Paul, 138, finished 3rd, Hunter Waltzing, 285, finished 4th, Zach Winslow, 145, finished 5th, Logan Cox, 152, also placed 5th, and Braylon Cameron, 160, finished 3rd. Abraham Lincoln saw Jude Ryan at Class 145 punch his ticket to Des Moines as well, with a win over Norwalk's Landon Card. Ryan was the lone Lynx to qualify for state. The senior will make his first appearance to the well after a day that he won't ever forget. It's been an awesome day, Ryan said. I was super excited and ready to wrestle today. I just went out there and wrestled my matches, and it felt pretty good to not allow anyone to score on me. Hopefully I'll carry this momentum into the state tournament. I'm not satisfied with this, though. It feels good, but I want to get it done next week and get on that podium. Notably, Parker Herzog, 113, finished 4th, Connor Heitrich, 106, Seth Frush, 120, Aiden Keller, 138, finished 5th, Taylor Owens, 126, and Jose Avalos, 132, placed 6th. Camden Erickson, 160, and Carlos Andre, 182, also finished 5th. Warren Summers, 220, and Gabe Daniels, 285, each finished 5th as well. The Yellow Jackets did not have a state qualifier. Devin Bovee, 170, and Alex Contreras, 182, were the top finishers for TJ at 6th place. And then here is an update on the current standings. Number 1 is Valley, West Des Moines. Number 2 is Norwalk. Number 3 is Indianola. Number 4 is Carroll. Number 5 is Lewis Central. Number 6 is Abraham Lincoln. Number 7 is Denison Schleswig. And number 8 is Thomas Jefferson. So that concludes this local sports story, and it will be interesting to see how the state tournament looks as it quickly approaches here in Des Moines. And then another sports story. Super Bowl marks fulfillment of lifetime of coaching for Bruce Arians. This was written by Rick Stroud. There has been so many magical moments replaying in his mind since the Bucks won Super Bowl 55. The Gatorade bath, the soggy family embrace, the confetti in his first words to quarterback Tom Brady about a promise fulfilled. Bruce Arians still wanted to drink it all in, like the cold Bud Light in his right hand, the Lombardi trophy in his left, as the boat parade drifted down the Hillsborough River on a sun-splashed Wednesday afternoon. And that's when all the moments became so momentous that they started to leak from the corners of his eyes. It still didn't hit me until we were about halfway down the river, and I'm holding the trophy over my head, and I said, "Holy cow, this is real." Aaron said, "I didn't cry, but I had a few tears fall and welled up." I said, "Oh, man." For the 68-year-old Arians, winning the Super Bowl as a head coach is validation of a remarkable career that began as a grad assistant at Virginia Tech more than 4.5 decades ago. It's not like he woke up the morning after the Bucks' 31-9 win over the Kansas City Chiefs as a smarter coach. "Heck no," Arians said, "but it changes life. It really does." To understand what Arians and the Bucks accomplished this season, you should begin with the ending. Shortly after the clock hit 0-0 and the cannons began exploding in the north end zone at Raymond James Stadium, Arians went looking for quarterback Tom Brady. When he found him, he threw his arms around the quarterback's neck and shouted in his ear above the noise, reminding Brady of their first conversation back in March. I said, "Remember the first talk we ever had? I said we were going to do this." Aaron said, "He said, hell yeah." The promotion was based on Aaron's beliefs that the Bucs were a quarterback away from being a Super Bowl contender when the 2019 season ended at 7-9. A year earlier, Aaron's was lured out of retirement from coaching by general manager Jason Licht, who needed someone to see if they could salvage Winston, the turnover-prone Heisman Trophy winner, from entering his fifth season with the Bucs. "We went on that really good stretch with James, and I thought we had it corrected. And in those last couple of ball games, it popped its head back up." Aaron said of Winston, who threw 30 interceptions, including pick sixes that cost the Bucs the final two games against Houston and Atlanta. "And it wasn't that we were done with him. It was okay. What's behind door number two? Let's research it." When Tom's interest was as high as it was, oof, let's move on it. By the time Aaron's was able to talk to Brady in March, his sales pitch was brief and to the point. "I said, we have one missing piece, and it's you and what you bring, more as a leader than a player," Aaron said. "Because this was a talented, talented football team a year ago, and we couldn't get out of our way because of the penalties and turnovers and beating ourselves." The Glazer family, which owns the Bucs, wasn't ready to give up on Winston just yet, even if his contract was up. Then it became, "Well, what if it's Tom Brady?" said Aaron's son, Jake, a former NFL kicker and contributor to the Draft Network. They said, "If that's the case, we're on board. Tom is brilliant. He knows the game. This is the best roster he's ever played." He said, "I'm in on all that." The COVID-19 pandemic, which began to shake the world in March, called into question whether someone as old as Aaron's, who had battled cancer several times, should risk his health by coaching in the NFL. People were like, "You need to opt out. You're 68 years old. You've had cancer twice," Jake Aaron said. "He called me. We talk about everything." I was like, "You know what? I think you're healthier being at the complex and being tested every day, having those protocols, than you are playing golf. Then you're going to be pissed off that you're at a golf course instead of coaching the team." His dad also was fortunate that a year earlier, he was able to fill his staff with his former coaches and players who trusted and could delegate some authority. Then, as the final seconds melted off the clock, Aaron's was drenched with blue Gatorade. "It was everything you could ever dream about," he said. "Even the Gatorade bath, because that's a big part of it, and it's the first one I ever had. They tried it at Temple, and I was faster then, and I got away. I also had a brand new suit on, and I said, oh, no, you're not going to ruin this suit." After his embrace with Brady, Aaron's, his wife Christine, Jake, and daughter Christy Ann had a big family hug. And that concludes the story about the Super Bowl. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for February 15. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any questions or comments about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Karen Walser from Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. Thank you for listening.
This is Jim Ralston, and I'm with IRIS, Short Take, from the Iowa Curiosities. Farmers and their toys, Dyersville, Iowa. If the wisdom on bumper stickers is true, and those with the most toys truly do win, Then the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville is a winner many times over, with two floors of more than 30,000 farm toys and exhibits, ranging from row after row of common tractors to combines, harvesters, and haulers, all the way down the extensive agricultural machinery lineup to an anhydrous ammonia tanker. The museum is a shrine and miniature to the heavy equipment Iowa farmers fuss over, endlessly fix, periodically live in during planting or harvesting, and tirelessly operate to bring home the grain or the beans that bring home the bacon. And don't let the word toy fool you. The only thing toy-like about these farm toys is that they're built to 1/16th or 1/32nd scale, and don't have internal combustion engines. This is Iowa, after all. Farm machines aren't child's play, even when they're toys. Most of the toys are stunningly accurate, not to mention beautiful. Replicas of tractors or combines with particular makers like John Deere and Case, from particular years, with details accurate down to the windshield wipers. Children play with these toys not only to have fun, they got a vocational education in heavy equipment. Highlights of the museum include an exhibit explaining the notion of scale that features a full-size replica of a John Deere tractor accompanied by a row of successfully smaller scale models, from 1/2 scale all the way down to a realistically looking tractor you can carry in your pocket. Upstairs, look for more tractors and harvesters, enclosed in glass cases, more perhaps than you've ever hoped to see. And though the word toy does technically appear in this museum's name, don't expect much playing around. Tractors, trucks, trailers, and combines, even at 1/32nd or 1/64 scale, are way too wrapped up in Iowa's blood, sweat, and sorrow to be simple objects of play. Don't be surprised if you see some old-timer kicking the tires of a tiny Case combine, wondering how it would hold up harvesting more than 2,000 acres. Or some young, unquietly cussing pocket-sized John Deere because it won't turn over. The National Farm Toy Museum is at the intersection of US 20 and Iowa Highway 136 in Dyersville. Open daily from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., the museum also hosts a number of special events. Exhibits throughout the year, the largest of which is the granddaddy of all farm toy shows, held the first full weekend in November. For more information, call 563-875-2727 or visit www.nationalfarmtoymuseum.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.